Well, let's take our seats. I think I should say that that there are publications on the table near the door that you're welcome to pick up, and they include a series of articles in Northern Perspectives. One is called Native Rights in Norway. Another is called Australia, Native Rights in Another Land. And another is called Greenland, Lessons of Self-Government and Development, and copies have been made, and please take copies of each with you. They, of course, are not as up-to-date as the material that or the accounts that have been given today by those present, but you may find them useful. Could I also say that Bill Dubay, publisher of the Arctic Slope Review, Arctic Policy Review, forgive me, is willing to arrange tomorrow at noon for any of you who wish to do so a visit to look at the North Slope Burrows Coastal Mapping Project. This is a very sophisticated computerized mapping operation covering the whole of the Arctic coast of Alaska, which falls, of course, within the North Slope Burrow. And Bill is over here by the taco counter. And if you want to take advantage of Bill's offer, you might speak to him and let him know, and give him your name, and he can arrange that during the lunch break tomorrow for those of you who'd like to take a look at that. So we are now back with Mark Gordon, and Dennis Patterson has the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just on trends as far as overemployment of Aboriginal women in response to your question of me, we don't see any discernible trends in the Northwest Territories in that direction. I do recognize that it's a source of social discord and may have influenced a trend towards mixed marriages because conflicts do arise between men and women when the women are able to get into the wage economy easier than their mates. But the dominant theme in the NWT, I would say, is unemployment at the community level, and women are fairly well represented in education, but not too well represented otherwise. So it's not, it hasn't emerged as a clear problem at this point yet. Thank you. And my question, if I may, is I was really intrigued, since I am still involved in education, to see the small high schools policy that's developed in Alaska, where every community has a high school, or almost every community now has a high school, and to learn of the dramatic results this has apparently produced in increasing success and social happiness amongst young Native Alaskans. I was wondering, I know that Kativik School Board had quite a disastrous attempt to start a high school in Montreal. I wonder if Mr. Gordon would just tell me how you're making out in training people at the high school level and beyond in your area now, and whether students have to leave communities yet to go to school, high school.
In In the area of education, we did have one disastrous attempt in trying to set up sort of like a boarding school in the city of Montreal. What's happening in most of our villages is that the school level usually goes up towards the high school level, and then after that, because there's very few that would stay in school long enough to continue on through the high school levels. What's usually the trend, and has been for the last since we started going to school, my generation included, was that once the students hit about 16, 17 years old and have the ability to enter the job market, and that they tend to go leave the schools. Now, the reasons we used to leave was that we had to be away from home, and usually this was the biggest factor in making people go to leave school and to go back home, because we had to go to schools in the south, and even though there was all the government programs and subsidies and that enabled us to go to the higher education in the south, this is still basically the same practice being continued today. But there is now getting to be a better turnout of students staying in school longer now. That situation is improving slowly. Still, again, here's the same problem. People have to leave once they reach a certain level. It varies from village to village. In the larger communities, I think Chaimo is supposed to have its first two high school graduates this year. That's a village of 1,000 people. And education in Chaimo has been around for a lot longer than other villages, up to about 25 years. So this gives you an indication of the success rate of people passing through the schools. Now that we have control of our own education system, so what's happening is that there's we're getting large. The student population is growing so fast. We're getting larger facilities, and all these old facilities. What we are hoping to do, and we are working this jointly between Mekivik Corporation, the Kennebec School Board, and the regional government, who all have training programs throughout. What we plan to do with these old facilities is try to use them as adult education centers or for secondary level education centers throughout the area, and also to do some vocational training within the region. Right now, we still have to send most of our students out, but the situation is changing over slowly so that we will have more people to be able to complete their schooling in the north. Because of the people dropping out early in school, entering into the job market, what we found is that we've had to put in quite a few training programs for these people to try and bring their educational levels back up and to be able to be an effective part of the job market. For instance, in Mekivik, we have a college credit level bookkeeping and financial management courses that we do internally on-the-job training type arrangements. And these on-the-job type training arrangements seem to have a better success rate than somebody entering into a school and just learning for a few years because of the poor economic conditions in the communities. Everybody in the family who can make money should be out making money for the rest of the people, and there's a lot of pressure for young people to go out and be useful to their family immediately, even though that we will say stay in school so you can have a good job, but in reality the social pressures are that the person should be producing for his family. So there is this pressure that is there. You don't want, a lot of people would try to say, no, we're encouraging our people to go to school. But in reality, in how the social milieu works in the village, these people are given a great deal of pressure to produce for their own families, to bring in some income. One other thing, too, that that discourages a lot of young people is that once they hit about 16 years old, they're supposed to have the ability to hunt and to carry out the full range of traditional activities. Being in school does not allow you to do that. And so it's always been in conflict with the traditional activities, the skills you're supposed to be able to have acquired as a native person by this age. So the introduction of the traditional courses, the hunting courses and things like that into the schools has helped this somewhat, but still falls short of what is really required of that person as a native person. In terms of his standing in the village. So these factors are, I don't know how we're going to resolve them, but we're trying our best at it. I guess there's going to have to be still a few years of experimentation where we'll have some success and some failures, but that we have not quite resolved yet. But there is starting to be all the group of people that have been dropping out of school have been coming back for training programs, on-the-job training programs, and some of them will take short-term courses in the south, and we're also establishing courses in the north for various skills, and that's helping bring back these people and get them back into the educational systems, and would enable them to be able to enter the job markets more effectively. I hope that answers your question.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Steve Kakwe.
The question I have with regard to the concern that all Aboriginal people have for the environment and in the management of the resources on it. My question is there in the agreement that you have any measures taken to have participation in environmental protection of the Inuit and also for the management of game, and is it adequate now? You were making a point earlier that you felt that there was some money lacking for participation in research, and if there's some deficiencies in the present setup, what would you recommend if you had another go at it?
Okay, the relating to the environmental protection in terms of protecting the environment in light of developments taking place in our areas. There's an Environment Quality Commission that is set up by the James Bay Agreement where there is it's an independent board where you have native representation, governmental representation in there, and this has all those, it can conduct public hearings. There is a whole list of developments that automatically must go through the commission and must have the hearings. I had the honor of serving on this commission for a couple of years, and the assessments we've been doing have up to now have not dealt with projects of developers coming in. A lot of the assessments that we've done so far through the Environment Quality Commission have dealt with our villages directly, such as trying to determine a new waste disposal site. We had to turn down some of our villages' applications because they weren't environmentally sound. But the mechanisms are in place. This commission has authority, and it gives us an opportunity, a forum, to be able to clear the concerns that the people have and to try and come up with solutions. The commission could say that a project cannot go ahead regardless of whether it's a multi-billion-dollar hydro project or not, they can disallow it, but their decision can be overturned by the Minister of Environment in Quebec. Now, I see, you know, this seems to be sort of contradictory to what we've been trying to establish, but at that point, the minister would be hard-pressed to show the reasons why he would overturn the decision of the commission, and he'd have to do it publicly. So we have that in our favor. If the commission, with the expertise in the commission, and the witnesses that they are able to call to this, the minister would have to really demonstrate good, sound reasons for why they would want to overturn the decision of the commission. So it does have quite a bit of authority in terms of environmental protection. Now, in terms of wildlife management or game management, what I've been saying is that there are some protections in here, but regardless of the protections, what's really made the difference is that we've spent our own money on it, and also and did our own population counts and checking the health of the animals. We've been able to set up a system where the reporting of kills and catches have, we get annual reports of exactly what our villages are taking. We know how many fish they're catching a year. We know exactly how many birds are caught, how many eggs are gathered. All of this is now, we've put in statistics and we've computerized the system. It gives us an incredible tool for our own internal management. But the credibility of these figures have been accepted by government now. They're the most accurate kill statistic figures that they can come across in any native community right now. Because there are there's a very narrow margin of error, because we're actually recording as the kills are being taken. And these are all done by our own people. This is what's made the difference, is that we went and took our own initiative in this area. And because we did this, now the governments are turning around and contracting our services to do the biological research work they need to do their own management decisions. We did the whale population counts for the federal government. We did our own eider duck study. We're trying to determine the sustainable yield for the char in various rivers in our area. This is what's made the difference. Whatever you might get in an agreement, or whatever you will get in writing for hunting rights, may protect you from the brunt of regulatory authorities. But to be actually involved in game management, you're going to have to take your own initiative, spend your own money, and get moving on it, and try to use the information that you have within. You see, the problem with a lot of wildlife research work, they've always been done by academics flying in from the south, do their own studies, they don't explain what they're doing, and they go back south, and they come up with, surprise, surprise, here's some new regulations for you. See, now that we have the system set up, they have to at least explain to the village, and we can translate the scientific terminology to something that the people could understand. And we have the people, the manpower in place to be able to make this interaction work. So so what I'm saying here is, you know, don't think that the whatever agreement you get on hunting rights is going to solve your problems. You're going to have to do a lot of your own work.
Doug Sanders?
Just a moment.
Sorry. Go ahead.
When you're saying you spent your own money on it, you're not talking about the money of the regional government, but Mackivic Corporation specifically.
Yes.
Okay.
And the regional government through, you see, we've used also some of the Hunter Support Program money to go into research. Particularly when we needed research funds, and these are funds that are under our control that the government can't regulate directly because of the provisions in the agreement. But we've used some of those funds to study the sustainable yield in a couple of our rivers for char. And we've also been entering into joint projects with the Quebec government to trying to determine what kind of fisheries resources we could develop and trying to see how that, what direction we should go in that area, and doing some exploratory activities in trying to establish untapped resources in the oceans.
The reason I'm pursuing this question is because in the Northwest Territories of Canada, at least with the Dena Nation, we've been actively taking part in all type of public hearing processes. Every time there's a major project being initiated, we participated at some time. Some of these taking part in hearings that we have no resources to take part in. And it's after making a commitment to take part that sometimes we find ourselves with no money, actually, participating with no money. But having no choice, but because that's the interest of our membership that we do this. And I guess the question I'm just trying to take a run at, trying to throw some light on whether or not governments could be convinced, you know, that is a prerogative and a right of all Aboriginal people, and that some participation, some resources should be established in the negotiations of a claims process to Aboriginal groups to participate in environmental regimes, in hearings, and as you say, to actually participate in research ourselves. That was the reason I was asking these questions, Mark.
Thank you.
I think that was an observation Doug Sanders.
Okay, two questions. Firstly, I understand at least as of a couple of years ago that the Cree regarded the guaranteed income program for hunters and trappers as one of the more successful aspects of their agreement. I wondered if the Inuit, in retrospect, thought it might have been a mistake not to have gone for that.
No, not at all. I'm not saying that the hunter support program that we opted for as opposed to the guaranteed income is perfect, but it's been one of the most successful elements as well in our agreement, but because it's a direct subsidy to the more traditional activities. It's an interjection of cash into this that was badly needed. But I don't think we would have traded that off for a glorified welfare system, as we would refer to the Crees agree, what they agreed to.
Second point. There has been quite a bit of discussion about public versus non-public. And in the meetings leading up to the First Minister's Conference of last week, there was a tendency by some of the provincial governments involved in the process to use the Inuit choice of public government, quote-quote, as an argument for rejecting positions being put forward by other groups. And this has given rise to, I think, some controversies about what people mean and some confusion about what public government means, what ethnic government means, or whatever the alternatives are.
Well, we never intended to, because the approach we've taken, we've never intended to for it to be used by the governments to contradict what the Indian groups are trying to get. And unfortunately, the governments are turning around using this. But you see, the system which is adopted by most of the Indian groups have been that the land, self-government, these institutions have all been lumped into one. What we did was we separated out our notions of ownership as being, and our native rights And we separated that out from the delivery of services and exercise of democratic rights and things like that. There are things that are attainable through existing mechanisms. What we did was we didn't try to lump everything under one grand authority, which seems to be the tendency for the groups that are living in reserves further to the south of us, the Indian groups in Canada. There's a tendency that the ownership of land and government and all of this are all linked into one. We've taken the approach of separating out the notion of land ownership and governmental control and separated out the two. The municipal authorities can make regulations over our lands, but we are the owners of those lands. Much like people in the city of Anchorage, there's individuals who own some land, but the municipal authority has regulatory authority over and above that. Well, we've separated out the two and left the regulatory authority as a separate entity, a different entity, and we opted for non-ethnic institutions in most of these public sectors activities, such as the education, the school boards, although there are some particular guarantees that enable us to do our own curriculum development and things like this, the small twists and changes here and there to accommodate for us. On the notion of purely ethnic things such as land ownership, hunting rights, compensation for development and that, we have another whole series of institutions which are ethnic. I'm not saying that our choice is better necessarily, but it's the approach that we've adopted.
On that, you would agree that the use of the public form for the governmental institutions as opposed to the landholding institutions is a choice that you could only logically make in a situation as the one you are in which you are a clear majority in the area?
Well, you see, in our area, with a population of only 5,000 and with the mineral resources in that area, we could be outnumbered tomorrow. But we tried to put enough safeguards into the institutions that we have established so that we couldn't just be overridden, okay? We have the protections through our ethnic institutions, and we've got specific guarantees and rights put in that side of the equation. But we also, in the more public institutions, we've also built in some safeguards into that, the right to use your own language in those institutions. The way the regional government is set up is that it's a representation by village as opposed to by population. One mining town would have two votes, even though it had a population of 10,000. The other thing, too, is that through the governmental authorities, what we could do is, instead of having villages established for a specific development, what we could do is class those things as work camps. Then that way, they don't have any direct authority or no direct involvement in the governmental institutions of the region. You see, when we went into this, we didn't try to build an ice wall, to protect so much. What we did was we went in with an aggressive attitude. What do we need to be able to succeed in this society? What do we need to be able to succeed in the province of Quebec? And we try to take the same approach into the constitutional discussions. It's not, the safeguards and that we are obviously going for that, but for the most part, we try to take the more aggressive view. What do we need to be able to take care of ourselves? We don't want to be taken care of. And we try to translate that into all the other areas that we deal with. You see, we're not asking for a historic apology. We don't want anybody to feel sorry for us. All we want is the means to be able to survive.
In this process you've stated the practical approach which led to your conclusions. Was there any discussion about how concepts of traditional sovereignty would be linked to these new institutions? Well, or was that simply not the concern?
We won't even use the word sovereignty. That's an English word, and you guys can attach whatever importance you want to it. What we want to do is do it by accomplishments, by actions, as opposed to grand theories. You have some groups that are screaming that they have sovereignty, but you turn around, sovereignty, you have to be able to pay for it, too. I don't know. We simplify the theories of sovereignty to very simple things, like who has the biggest guns, and also how sovereignty's actually worked for us. It's not the fact that we had big guns, but that our climate was just something that nobody else wanted.
All right.
Thanks.
I think we'll... Bill Erasmus.
Thank you. I am concerned with your strategy when you first began to negotiate. Since 1973, Canadian policy has suggested that when you're dealing with comprehensive claims, that you have to prove a traditional land use or a traditional land base. And you earlier mentioned a large area of about a third of Quebec included into the agreement. And I'm curious as to how you arrived at that large area.
Well, if you start talking about traditional areas, you know how far back do you go? If we went back and went traditional, if you took the measure of when the first white men came, we by rights should have been able to make a claim down as far as Quebec City, because the Inuit occupied the area roughly the north of the 55th, down the Labrador coast, and around the bend, the north shore of the St. Lawrence. Now, after the white man came, he armed the Indians around Quebec City and drove us back up the Labrador coast. Now, how far back do you go to claim the traditional areas? There's always been this constant struggle between the native societies themselves. We've been at war with other native groups longer than the white man. In fact, we never fought the white man, but we fought more with the other native groups. And this is a historic reality, but on the notion of what is, where do you cut it off? Do you start 6,000 years ago? Do you start 100 years ago? It's a very, very relative term and arbitrary, in my view. Basically, it's what areas you're occupying and using now. That's really the real measure that when you talk about traditional areas, the traditional areas that are recognized and the ones that are being on the basis in which negotiations are being done are actually present occupations, not traditional. Traditional occupations have fluctuated back and forth as far back as you go.
I'm asking because there's a situation coming up. Well, it's been developing over the years, and that's exactly what it is. It's traditional versus contemporary. I live in Alberta now. Does that mean that that's considered my traditional area? So, it's a complex question. I guess I should have added to it, in when you did begin to negotiate, did you have to provide specific evidence? I know some of the Inuit groups provided their Inuit land use study. I'm not aware if you were a part of that, or and to add, how did the government respond? Were they, did they throw it out the door, or?
No, you see, convincing the governments, what convinced the government wasn't the studies showing where we are and things like that. What convinced the government was the court case. The question of traditional areas is more of an internal argument between native groups than with governments. It's trying to determine those boundaries between this group of natives and that group of natives. I realize that it's often used as a criteria to try and establish a claim, and usually you have to try and prove it to the government that you've traditionally occupied these areas. You know, the question is for us in any way has been more trying to sort out the areas of interest between ourselves and the Crees, ourselves and the Naskapis. It's been more that traditional area argument has been more internal amongst the natives than it has been with the governments.
Okay, a further question. Dealing with your corporations, I understand, correct me if I'm wrong, that you have in your region some corporations, or you had corporations prior to the settlement. I'm interested as to what has resulted since the establishment of your corporations. In other words, is there a measure of competition between the cooperatives and the corporations? And if so, how you're dealing with them?
We didn't have corporations. What we had before was cooperatives, and one of our villages, George River, has the oldest Inuit cooperative in Canada, and these are very strong institutions. Now, strong in the sense that they have a lot of political backing and a long established standing within our own native community. Initially, there was a very strong competition between the two. The Co-op Federation, in fact, went so far as to fund the dissident group to be able to fight against us. We also went into competition over some of the business ventures as well with them. But what we found was that we would be funding a landholding corporation to set up, a small snack bar, and the co-op would already have one set up, and they would start competing, and then there wasn't enough revenue in the whole village to be able to sustain two of them, so they would both go broke. And after a few of these fiascos, we started coming together and saying, okay, let's cut out the unnecessary competition between the two of us. And in fact, because the cooperatives and the art market has crashed quite badly in Canada, especially for the Inuit cooperative movement, which derived a large part of their income through the art market, they've been having very, very tough time economically in recent years. And in fact, what's happening now is that Mekivik funds are being used to guarantee loans for the cooperatives and to direct loans as well to the cooperatives. One village cooperative we lent some money to couldn't make its payments, so instead of calling the loan on them, what we did was we accepted carvings instead of payments.
Okay, my last question. It's dealing with what you call the dissident group. I thought I heard you say that because of their dissident nature or their opposition, you have been able to succeed more in your political aspirations with the Quebec government. Is that correct?
Yes, it's worked out in a funny way. It's been also been used against us in many respects. When we want to go for something, they say, well, you don't have a consensus. For some reason, all the high democratic principles that are adopted by our governments, provincial and federal governments, when it comes to native consensus, it has to be 100%. That's a pretty strong measure for democracy. But despite this fact, what in effect has happened is been able to reserve the more radical view and give it credibility, so that we've always been able to say, well, look, if you don't agree with us, you sure as hell aren't going to agree with them. So in that sense, we've been able to leapfrog over each other to make political gains. But I would like to make one observation. No matter what kind of a settlement you come up with, there'll always be somebody saying, oh, that's not enough. So I wouldn't be surprised once you get into any claim settlement anywhere else, you're going to end up with a dissident group. It may not take the form that ours did.
Sam Silverstone, you wanted to add something to what Mark said?
Yes. Is the mic on? I had some additional comments. Steve Kafkwi asked some questions with respect to the environmental regime and the degree of participation. The environmental regime, Inuit put a lot of resources into getting some provisions in the agreement dealing with environment. And as a supplement to what Mark said, at that time, there was no environmental policy in Quebec, or the policy was that there was no policy. And there was no comprehensive energy policy in Quebec. So we weren't just fighting. We weren't just, as they had already had an Ontario Environment Assessment Act, we weren't just getting amendments to an existing act. We were fighting a very intransigent government. We had to educate the government as to what was going on in other jurisdictions to justify our case for a proper impact assessment procedure in Northern Quebec. Because the existing impact assessment procedure under the Environment Quality Act of Quebec 1972 was inadequate. And as Mark said, the Act required regulations to have force, and the only regulations they had adopted were with respect to bottled water that's sold in the supermarkets. So we were starting really from ground zero. In terms of the energy policy, we were facing off against the energy developers. Now, they sure as hell didn't want any policy, and they didn't want any environmental provisions. And as a matter of fact, when we sat down with the Environment Quebec people to negotiate, the developers were at the table, and basically they dictated the provisions. And when Environment tried to assert their jurisdiction, Energy had private meetings with them and said, hey, listen, this is what you're going to say and this is what you're going to agree to. But irrespective of that, we came up with a regime, because we put a lot of our resources into it, we came up with a decision-making body, whereas the Crees came up with a recommendatory body. We came up with a body that has the power to make a decision, a go with respect to a project, to give a green light, to give a red light. And in exceptional circumstances, as Mark said, the Lieutenant Governor can exempt the project, or the Minister can overturn a decision, but it has to be it's subject to publicity, and he has to give good reasons for doing so. The other element about the environment regime is that you have to look at the agreement as a whole. Though we may have a good impact assessment process, it has to be balanced with some of the other areas, such as the right to develop was recognized in the agreement. Even though this was a native land claim settlement, throughout the settlement appears this right of the government to develop the territory. And that's tied to the comments I made at the beginning of the hearings this week, that the statement of principles is very important. If it's a native land claim settlement, then that should be the thrust of the principles that guide interpretation of it. And what's happened to our agreement is there's native land claim principles mixed with government development principles. And so when you go to interpret that, which takes precedence? The other supplementary point that Bill Erasmus, this is just another point with respect to a question Bill Erasmus put. There's no doubt that a solid land use study would have assisted us in negotiating. As Mark pointed out, it's been used, our land use data has been used more to determine how the Niskapis use our area, how the Crees share certain hunting fishing areas. And that opens up a whole other question as to, once we settled our claims with Canada and Quebec, then the Niskapis negotiated their claims and carved out of our area. The government set it up so that the Niskapis were facing off against Inuit and Cree to get their claims, rather than it. So it looked like we were refusing their claims rather than the government. But in fact, the government had set that up. But there's no doubt, had we had a well-documented a land use study such as the Labrador Inuit prepared with the telltale title, Our Footprints Are Everywhere, it would have assisted us in just getting our own position together. But there wasn't that type of time for preparation or finances for preparation.
There's one general observation I wanted to include in my presentation I'd like to make now. Now that we have all these notions of ownership of land and things like that worked out in our claim settlement, we're starting to find that there are some gaping holes in terms of how we can resolve our internally the question of land ownership. And you see, the lands are held collectively through a corporation. Now, there's some interesting questions that are inevitably going to arise. If you have a piece of property, the land is owned by the community, and the community decides that it's in the community benefit to take over somebody's trapping lodge and because it's their land, and develop a tourist industry or something around that area, what rights does that individual have for compensation from his own village? These types of questions are slowly starting to come up, and there is nothing to deal with them. It would make a very interesting court case, but I would hope that we didn't have to go that far. We are starting to find out that there's going to be areas of dispute in the notion of collective rights of the native people and the individual rights. I'll go into this further when we talk a bit more about the constitutional issue. We went quite far in trying to preserve certain notions of collective rights. And in doing so, we forgot the individual protections required by the individuals within our collectivities. And just one observation about the whole constitutional discussions. Everybody's screaming about collective rights, but our societies have the same capacity of doing injustice to individuals. So we need some kind of general protections for the individuals within our notions of collective rights. It's all good and well to...